said that that morning it was only 11 a.m. in the morning that they had been on five calls, but they had only been on five calls that morning because they couldn't get to the other 11 that were happening. So it's a human tragedy what's happening in San Quentin, and the incarcerated people that are there are living in fear.
Well, Rashid Lockhart, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Rashid worked as an incarcerated firefighter at San Quentin State Prison, was released in January, now an organizer with Planting Justice in Oakland. And this update in the police shooting in Kenosha, Wisconsin, of Jacob Blake, an unarmed 39-year-old black man. Blake's father says his son is now paralyzed from the waist down. Protests continue there and across the country. Blake's father will also speak at the virtual march on Washington, D.C. this weekend, along with other family members. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Happy birthday to Julie Crosby and Vesta Goodars.
KBOO Portland.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. Due to the COVID-19 pandemic, KBOO will be sticking to our regularly scheduled programming as much as possible, but there are some limitations that we're working with, so we appreciate your understanding and support. We are committed to keeping our staff, volunteers, and programmers safe and healthy, so we are transitioning to producing programs remotely. For updates on KBOO's response to the COVID-19 pandemic, visit our website at kboo.fm/COVID-19. That's kboo.fm/COVID-19.
25 years ago, the United Nations held its fourth and so far final World Conference on Women. Events began August 30, 1995 in Wairo, China, and concluded September 15th in Beijing. The one-week non-governmental forum hosted more than 30,000 people. The official meeting had more than 17,000 from 189 countries. This was not a one-off event. Numerous national, regional, and international meetings were held to prepare for it, and many more since, seeking implementation of the plan of action that governments unanimously approved. This week, and for the 2 weeks that follow, WINGS commemorates the conference with stories from 1995.
The Chinese Lexicon Project, created by Sharon Hom, was explained in detail in Oklahoma City at an official U.S. preparatory meeting for the United Nations Fourth World Conference on Women. Sharon Hom teaches law at the City University of New York School of Law and in China.
In Tianjin last year, I did a workshop with Chinese women, about 100, and I said, I want you to come up with the first saying in Chinese that you can think of that has to do with Chinese women. Now, these are women who do work on women's issues. So we came up with a list, and then I looked at the list. Every one of them was negative. So I said, this underscores the importance of paying attention to how we talk and to create new language.
The Lexicon Project was born out of the first joint conference of women scholars from China and the U.S.
There was a very ritzy conference funded with lots of money, and this was the first time for many of those Chinese women outside of China. And there were panels and workshops on gender and reproduction and everything else, except law, interestingly. So I was astounded by the presentations. And the one that really triggered it for me was to listen to a panel of all white Western women talking about Chinese women's subjectivity. And then when someone talked about the provisional contingent and what Chinese women need to do was to claim their alternative subject positionalities, my eyes crossed. And I looked at my Chinese counterparts and I said, gosh, what is going through those headphones? how could that have been translated into Chinese? And I would like to know what it was, right? And then in the question and answer, I got up and I went to the mic and I said, I'm sorry I didn't have a headphone on, but I would like to know what the translation was for counter-hegemonic reification. And furthermore, what does it mean in English? So there were, and when I said the question, and then the question was easily translated to Chinese, the Chinese looked up and started laughing. So that made me start thinking. So I started talking to the women in the hallways, the Chinese women from China, and they said to me, and what work unit are you from? Because in China, everyone belongs to a work unit, a danwei. I said, oh, I said, my work unit is the City University of New York Law School, and I'm based in New York. And we started talking about the words that people were using and absolutely assuming, you know, was being translated. And I'll tell you just the three that got me thinking about the project. Gender was translated many different ways. None of them had any correlation to what, even in this room of us here, might even agree was a definition of gender. In the Chinese, every version came out with the clear connotation that this was biologically determined. The other big word was sexuality. Now, we know there's sex in China. That's why we're having this big problem with trying to do this population thing, right? The problem was we couldn't translate sexuality because sexuality has connotations of pleasure and passion and sex for sex's sake and not reproduction or trying to produce the son. And they couldn't come up with a word for sexuality, so the word came up something mumbled like, there's no sex, you know, something like that, you know? And then the other word was feminist. And so the translations for that was Nüchenzhuyi, which is very bad. It has this absolutely militant, angry, in-your-face, I don't care about you, women's rights. So that was one problem with the definition. The other problem with the words they were using was that feminism in China is state-sponsored. It's viewed as the policy of the party. So you will find many Chinese who will say, I am not feminist. And the struggle to claim those labels and to reject those labels will be absolutely what will be going on. And what you're going to get then, in contrast to that, is a very vocal, I will bet, group of primarily young women who will speak a discourse that you will feel comfortable with. So the danger will be that you will talk to just them. These are women who have read and want to talk to you about Gloria Steinem. These are the women who will talk to you of Western feminism and women's rights and claiming our voices and will say it in English to you. None of this translates easily into Chinese. So that was the main impetus for the Lexicon Project. My co-editor is a human rights scholar from Beijing, so she's the China contact person and I'm the US contact person. And we are editing a lexicon which we hope will fit in your back pocket, because I will, those of you who are there can come and find me and pay me my dollar, because I will bet my bottom dollar that your translators may not be able to find the quick word for sexuality, but you will find it in our book. So what we will have in the lexicon are not translations of all the words, because that's the problem. So what we will have is the word, and then there will be a suggested Chinese word, but then we're going to do like a paragraph on each of these words that says, this is why the word is difficult. This is why it's hard to use the word. So we have 300 words, and in the dictionary of 300 words, I don't want to use dictionary, so that's why we're using lexicon. A lot of the words are starred. The starred words are real upfront owning up to saying, these words either do not currently exist in Chinese, and we know it, so we're making up a word. Where we say very clearly, we say, this is about creating a new language in Chinese so we can talk to each other about terms we need to use.
That was Sharon Hom, originator of the Chinese Lexicon Project. The Fourth World Conference on Women will be held in Beijing in September 1995. Reporting for Wings, this is Lisa Hayes.
One of the controversies of the coming Fourth World Conference on Women centers around whether or not women exiled from Tibet will be allowed by the Chinese government to attend. China has occupied Tibet since the 1940s and has forced Tibetans to conform to Chinese ways. Listen as Lobsang Dechen of the Tibetan Nun Project expresses her concerns.
As I'm a nun, I'm concerned about so many nuns in the prisons. They went for the peaceful demonstration. They wanted to express their abuse. They wanted to express their sufferings. They're put in prison, they torture them, and there's no right of expression.
The Chinese government handpicked 80 Tibetan women to attend the conference, but Tibetan exiles want their own representatives. Tsering Norzom is the president of the Tibetan Women's Association, an independent Tibetan organization.
We have evident proof that the Tibetan women who live as refugees in exile will be denied access to participate in the conference, because the All China Women's Federation representative, she made it clear that Tibet is an internal part of China and that they will be dealt according to the Chinese law. And further to add to it, when I approached Mrs. Gertrude Mongela, the General Secretary of the Fourth World Conference on Women, and apprised her about the access problems that the Tibetan women who live as refugees might face, she said that Tibetan women from Tibet have already registered for the conference and that we coordinate with them.
Yang Ying is a Tibetan woman who did not choose exile. She was elected by the Chinese government as president of the Women's Federation of Tibet. She explains that the only way the exiled women can attend the World Conference on Women in China is if they renounce their independent Tibetan citizenship and enter as Chinese citizens. Here is Yang Ying in translation.
As a woman, personally, they have the right to attend the conference. But if they practice independence, Tibetan independence, this will be not allowed by people from Tibetan Autonomous Region. So if they recognize themselves as a citizen or as a woman from Tibetan Autonomous Region of the People's Republic of China and applied to Tibetan Women's Federation, as a member of Tibetan Women's Delegation, then it's okay.
Tsering Norzom responds.
Those Tibetan women who will be brought into the conference by the Chinese government will not be able to speak the true situation of the Tibetan women inside Tibet, because they will be made to speak under pressure and threat for themselves and for their families, which means that they will say that everything in the status of Tibetan women inside Tibet is fine. And so we as Tibetan women who live in exile as refugees, who have maximum number of freedom, we speak as the voice, as the true voice of every Tibetan woman in and outside Tibet, and it is our moral responsibility to see that the true situation of the Tibetan women is highlighted in this conference, and that women of the world take note of the sufferings that the Tibetan women have been undergoing under the Chinese oppression inside Tibet and outside Tibet.
Yang Ying, the official representative, calls the independent Tibetan women troublemakers. Her view is that the Tibetan women in China are living happy lives, and the women of the world will see for themselves when they come for the conference.
I think all the people, except those people who have a hostile attitude, are welcome. And you can see the changes of Tibetan people with your own eyes.
What others call the occupation of Tibet, Yang Ying calls the liberation of Tibet by China. She says that when she was a child, Tibet was under a feudal system and her family were serfs.
From 8 to 15 years old, I was a serf for a noble family, and the life was miserable. And when Tibet was liberated, that was in the year 1959, I had a chance to go to school and to the university. And I got a job upon graduation to do women's work. And I have been doing this for many years. And now I'm the chairwoman of the Tibetan Women's Federation. Now my husband has his job. I have two daughters and two grandchildren. And the family is very happy and harmonious.
Those were representatives of both sides of the controversy surrounding the denial of access by the Chinese government to independent Tibetan women wanting to attend the Fourth World Conference on Women in Beijing. Interviews were recorded by Maria Suarez and Elaine Clift. Reporting for Wings, I'm Lisa Hayes.
From the Wings Archive, these are stories about the United Nations Fourth World Conference on Women in 1995.
During the first week in September, the United Nations Fourth World Conference on Women will be held in Beijing, China. The China Organizing Committee is responsible for the preparations for the non-governmental forum on women, taking place alongside the official conference. Huang Qizhao is vice chairperson of the committee. The translator is Sung Hua Yan.
Now I would like to give you some of the names of the workshops.
妇女与科技发展,
Women and Science and Technology,
妇女与企业管理,
Women and Business Management,
妇女与工业发展,
Rural Women,
农村妇女,
Women of Ethnic Groups,
少数民族妇女,
Disabled Women,
老年妇女, 残疾妇女, 女童, 妇女与信贷,
Women and Credit, Women and the Traditional Chinese Traditional Medicine, Legal Status of Women, Women and Human Rights, Violences Against Women,
对妇女的暴力,
and Girls.
Do you think that having the conference in China will have a big effect on women's relationship with the government and to each other after the conference is over?
Half of the provinces, they have put a significantly greater amount of money for women's affairs, for the construction of women's activity centers. These activity centers are to provide services and skill training for the women in their localities. I'm not sure whether you have such kind of facilities for women, but in our country, such kind of facilities and constructions are going all out everywhere. And with the financial support of our government, ECWF is now constructing a national women's activity center, which covers an area of 36,000 square meters. This center will be completed before the convening of the conference.
中国的妇女都可以进去，这个中心呢就建在北京的最著名的街道长安街上。
This center is located in Beijing on the Changi Street, the most famous street in Beijing. And every woman, all the women, they can be there to have activities, such as providing services and training, skill training. So rural women, they can come to Beijing and stay there for a period of time.
还举一个例子，就是为了迎接这个大会，我们全国妇联。
Another thing I would like to share with you is that now in China, the women are building a China College for Women. This is a college for women exclusively, we can say that. And the money is raised by women themselves. But of course, we get some support from the central government. This support totaled 10 million yuan, 10 million yuan. The rest is raised by the women themselves. Before the convening of the conference and NGO forum, this college will be open to students. Six subject departments will recruit students: law, economic management, preschool education administration, foreign languages, secretary, and social work.
同时呢, 我们积极地为参与第44届妇女大会的非政府组织论坛呢, 进行这个会场的设施的准备。
Another thing, we have been actively working very hard to get ready the facilities for the NGO Forum on Women. And the China NGO Forum Organizing Committee has get ready 70 meeting rooms of various sizes for workshops, seminars, and panels, and also other kind of facilities for exhibitions, cultural events, and exchange of information and ideas. And we have also made arrangements for the NGO participants to visit rural and urban areas, such as factories, schools, farms, nurseries, and even to visit families and households. So we try to let the women of other countries know women of China, and let women of China know the women of other countries.
Huang Qicao, vice president of the All China Women's Federation, was interviewed by Frieda Werden at the final preparatory conference for the Fourth World Conference on Women. A few weeks after this interview, on April 4th, the Chinese announced a change in the site of the non-governmental forum. Instead of the stadium in central Beijing that the women's group had been preparing, they must meet in a resort village an hour from the city. Officials said structural problems had been discovered in the first site, but activists noted the effect was to marginalize non-governmental women away from the official UN meeting and away from contact with ordinary Chinese. The resort also lacks a large meeting space for 10,000 or more people, and 30,000 women are expected to attend. The change in plans followed a political shakeup in the Chinese government. Supatra Mazdit of Thailand, the official convener of the NGO forum, has traveled to China to negotiate for another site. For Wings, this is Lisa Hayes.
Women the world over are holding conferences to discuss priorities for the Fourth World Conference on Women next fall in Beijing. In Eastern Africa, some have prioritized the environment and the empowerment of the grassroots woman.
African women can do so much and are doing so much, but I feel that we can put our heads together and strategize on how we should really be empowered, especially the empowerment of the grassroots who do so much and who are really the managers and preservers of the environment.
In September 1994, women and men representing seven Eastern African nations came together for the African Regional Conference on Women, Environment, and Sustainable Development in Kampala, Uganda, organized by the Uganda Women Tree Planting Group. Prabha Bharadwaj recorded some of the speeches.
Now, the African people, like indigenous people the world over, were efficient managers of their environment. Their extreme dependence on natural resources for sustenance made this inevitable. They also possessed invaluable knowledge and techniques for preserving their environment. For example, it was taboo to cut certain trees believed to have water recycling powers. People in a village would wait for the sound of a certain horn, which announced the ripening of some wild fruits, before anyone dared to pick them, under fear of death or some mysterious mishaps. Communal grazing grounds for their animals were used in rotation to permit grass to grow and prevent overgrazing, and many more. But the colonial master interpreted all these strange traditional norms as pagan and set out to eliminate them, substituting them with, quote, civilized institutions. The result is that many of these invaluable indigenous techniques for environment preservation and resource management were gradually lost. Africans have thus lost many of their indigenous knowledge of medicinal herbs, of family planning, of controlling hypertension, and of curing many of the diseases associated with their environment.
One of the stated goals of the African Regional Conference on Women, Environment, and Sustainable Development was to help the seven participating countries implement policies drawn up by the African heads of state who attended the 1992 United Nations Conference on Environment and Development. However, these top-down strategies may not be the best way to proceed.
I've realized that working with grassroots women, instead of coming and imposing ideas on them, you sit with them, discuss what they want, look for solutions for what they want to do, and this will work. And this is what I would call the bottom-up approach. I've done it in my past 3 years in the AIDS program, where we had to sit down and look for solutions for the AIDS epidemic. Communities try to discuss what is the cause of AIDS in their community, what they think is bringing up AIDS in their community, and they try to look for solutions and checkpoints. For example, they feel having discos at night, having weddings at night is a problem and it's a predisposing factor to getting AIDS. In that way, they say in this village, no more disco after 6. And they will implement it because they are the implementing agents. But this issue of coming with an idea from national level or from international NGO, come and impose it on the community will not take it up. It is not their priority. They don't feel it is their problem. While in the other incidents of bottom-up, they bring up the problem, they try even to analyze what are the causes of the problem, solutions of the problem, and how best they can put checkpoints to the problem, or even how they can appeal for solutions for the problem.
A position paper from this conference will go to the African Preparatory Conference for the Fourth World Conference on Women in Beijing in September 1995. For Wings, this is Ginger Webb.
It's several weeks now since the UN Fourth World Conference on Women and NGO Forum ended in Beijing. The effects of the resolutions passed at the conference will influence government policy and women's lives for many years to come. Women garment workers and unionists met in Beijing to discuss the globalisation of garment production, the problems and struggles faced by women working in this worldwide industry, and to set up networks between women around the world. Annie Delaney from the Textile Clothing and Footwear Union of Australia was there. She caught up with Laura Fu, a member of the San Francisco-based Asian Law Caucus, a civil rights advocacy group that represents garment workers in the US. The different perspectives and needs of women was illustrated by the controversy surrounding the use of Esprit tote bags at the conference. Laura explains her group's objections to Esprit's association with the forum.
When we came here, the first thing that happened was we got these tote bags with the Esprit label on it. They provided it to the forum participants to carry their things around in. And they had a little label in there that said Esprit was a company co-owned by a woman and they're committed to equality for women. And we've been working in the garment industry in San Francisco. We've had a long history of experience with Esprit, and we know that Esprit uses sweatshop labor in the production of its garments, not just in the United States, but all over the world. And so we thought that we needed to expose that. We couldn't let that company get away with pretending that it was a progressive company that was for equality for women. And so we put out a leaflet asking people to cut those labels out and send it back to the company to ask them to stop using sweatshop labor and to monitor their contractors to make sure that women got a living wage and worked under humane working conditions. And it caused a little bit of a controversy. The campaign to cut the labels got reported in the Forum 95 newspaper, which is the official newspaper for the conference. And it sort of provoked this response from Irene Santiago, who's the executive director of the NGO, where she defended their choice of Esprit as a socially responsible company. And Esprit themselves coming out saying that they get written guarantees from their suppliers who guarantee that they don't exploit their workers. Unfortunately, we didn't get a chance to respond in the newspaper before the final edition, but we did put out one more leaflet explaining exactly what Esprit did. Basically, 3 months ago, in March of 1995, the United States Department of Labor did a survey in San Francisco of about 40 shops. There were two Esprit shops among those 40, and both of those shops were found in violation of overtime wage laws and of workplace safety laws. And, you know, we weren't surprised. And every time the federal government does a survey of shops, Esprit shops end up on the list of as being violators. And it's a company with a long history of anti-worker activities. You know, in 1974, its own branch company tried to unionize. And this was about 60 Chinese immigrant garment workers. They were on the picket line in the branch company. Esprit closed that company, that factory down. So the women went out to the Minnesota Street headquarters, and while on the picket line, Esprit called out the police, who arrested all these women for supposedly blocking traffic. They were taken down to the police station, humiliated by being strip searched. And after that, Esprit just busted the union drive by moving its entire operations to Hong Kong, and it stayed in Hong Kong for at least 10 years. Our federal courts found Esprit had violated labor laws by retaliating against the union drive by closing its shop down and ordered Esprit to reimburse these women their back wages. That's the way transnational deal with workers who begin organizing. They just shift from one country to another. Esprit is one of those companies, but Esprit is not alone. There's The Gap, Eddie Bauer, Lee Jeans,
just all the brand names that we've heard of, they do the exact same thing. They've moved from the United States to countries like Hong Kong and Taiwan and South Korea, and until those countries' wages went up higher than the transnationals wanted. And so from there, they've moved to Bangladesh and the Philippines and Thailand and Indonesia and Malaysia to get their work done even cheaper. And now a lot of work has moved to China. And the wages in China are even cheaper than places like Thailand. And so it's caused dislocation and unemployment in all the countries that they've left.
Laura Fu from the Asian Law Caucus, speaking with Annie Delaney at the NGO Forum in Beijing. You're listening to Women on the Line.
This has been the first of three WINGS programs, marking the 25th anniversary of the United Nations Fourth World Conference on Women, held in China from August 30th through September 15th, 1995. For a link to the Beijing Declaration and Platform for Action, search online or email wings@wings.org. WINGS thanks all our supporters, including your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, whose works can be found on the website gifteconomy.com. That's gift-economy.com. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Welcome to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program that showcases radio production by independent community media. We bring local stories to a national audience, produced at a different location every week. I'm Wayne Burtz of KRBX in Boise, Idaho. Today on Sprouts, you're about to hear episode one of a new serialized radio show and podcast created by KRBX and the Wild Lens Collective called Common Land. Common Land explores the creation stories behind protected areas, and the focus of our first season is the Morley Nelson Snake River Birds of Prey National Conservation Area, home to the highest nesting densities of birds of prey anywhere in North America.
I watched this fabulous aerial combat down in the Snake River Canyon for 40 years. Mm-hmm. There is nothing that matches the combat between an eagle and a prairie falcon, and an eagle and a prairie falcon and a red tail when they're fighting for nesting sites. Mm-hmm. And since there are so many, it goes on every day down there, and it is absolutely fantastic. But they never kill. The mountain lions fight over their nesting and their female. They never kill. The grizzly bears fight over their things. They never kill. And the falcons and the eagles do the same thing. Mm-hmm. And humanity did it once, just the other day, when they knocked the red communist in the head and didn't fire a shot.
That's the voice of Morley Nelson, recorded just a few weeks after the beginning of the demolition of the Berlin Wall. Morley was America's most famous falconer and advocate for protecting birds of prey. He was a celebrity in his hometown of Boise, Idaho, and his knowledge of the Snake River Canyon just south of town was unparalleled. Morley passed away in 2005 at the age of 88, but not before a handful of chroniclers were able to record his voice to tape, like this from the founder of the Archives of Falconry.
This is Kent Carney, and I'm at the home of Moreland W. Nelson in Boise, Idaho. It is 3 o'clock on the afternoon of the 5th of July, 1990.
It was the sport of falconry that led to Morley Nelson's obsession with birds of prey. Here is how Mr. Carney defines the sport that was the single greatest influence on Morley's life.
Technically speaking, the sport of falconry is the pursuit of wild quarry in its natural state and habitat by means of a trained bird of prey.
Morley brought falconry into the mainstream of American culture. He trained birds of prey for numerous Hollywood films throughout the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, and he convinced the biggest names in natural history filmmaking, Walt Disney and Marlon Perkins among them, to produce documentaries about birds of prey in the Snake River Canyon.
Hello, welcome to Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom. Right here in southern Idaho, along the Snake River, we finally found one of the heaviest populations of golden eagles in the world. We named it the Valley of Eagles. For eons of time, the Snake River has cut through layers of sandstone and lava to form these mighty cliffs, towering 1,000 feet in the air. Cliffs so high and jagged that Jim and I were glad to have an expert like Morley Nelson along to lead us to the nest of a pair of eagles he'd recently discovered.
Even if you haven't heard the name Morley Nelson, it's possible that you've seen one of his trained eagles or falcons in an old movie. Although it wasn't his original intention, it was Morley who was largely responsible for the establishment of a national conservation area in the Snake River Canyon of southwestern Idaho.
I never dreamt that there was the potential for a refuge.
Yeah.
I was thinking of some kind of a, I was trying to hope to change the law so we wouldn't shoot them all. Because they went down there to shoot the pigeons and they'd shoot the falcons and the eagles and God, I got wounded birds, you know, coming out my ears.
You're listening to Common Land, a new podcast series produced by the Wild Lens Collective and Radio Boise. I'm your host, Matt Podolsky. Common Land explores the untold stories behind protected areas. We'll explore the often complex realities behind the establishment of protected areas from all around the globe. In Season 1, we are exploring the creation story behind a 484,000-acre patch of protected land in Idaho, an area roughly half the size of Rhode Island. These desert canyonlands were set aside primarily to protect one particular group of animals, birds of prey. We're talking about the Morley Nelson Snake River Birds of Prey National Conservation Area, home to a unique assemblage of North American raptors.
Well, I was about 12 years old when I got the first hawk. And what I was doing, I was herding cattle in North Dakota on their land I still have, my grandfather's homestead. And I knew of the teal ducks. And even at 12 years old, we loaded our own shotgun shells and we shot our winter meat often. And I never could hit the teal.
Uh-huh.
And then one day I went to water my horse and I scared up these 7 teal that lived on the little pond there. And I don't know whether to this day whether it was a peregrine or a prairie falcon. It could have been either one. All I heard it coming, and these teal were about 50 to 75 feet in the air, and that character came down in a vertical stoop and busted one of those teal and rolled up over in the air and then took it out of the air before it ever hit the ground. And I was standing there with my horse in my hand, absolutely amazed, and I said, well, I got to get rid of that gun and get a hawk.
From that time on the farm when he saw that peregrine falcon take a teal duck, the stoop that he saw that day was the most magnificent thing he'd ever seen in his life. To this day, it was just like the singular moment, and then every other time he saw that, that was the coolest thing in the world.
Steve Stubner is the author of Cool North Wind, a biography of Morley.
For him, it was visceral. It was just like, whoa, did you see that? You know, and that was just like the thing that inspired his work for a lifetime.
Steve spent countless hours with Morley while working on his book, and he recorded many of their conversations with an old microcassette deck.
So your house was in Fargo, and he had a law practice there.
Well, that was after I was in grade school, up in 8th or 9th grade.
What about when you were born and first started?
I was out on the ranch.
Okay.
And I grew up out on the ranch, not milking cows, and getting up at 5:30 in the morning, and I still wake up at 5:30 every damn morning, including this morning.
Morley attended North Dakota State University in the 1930s, where he studied soil science. When World War II broke out, Morley was called to serve in the 10th Mountain Division.
In the closing months of 1944, forward units of the American Fifth Army were faced with the task of breaking through these ridges of the German Gothic defense line.
Morley was struck by shrapnel in 1944. The injury was serious, and it would mean the end of his combat experience in World War II.
I had two bullet holes in here, and they were below the bone, these little ones under here.
That's on your right arm,
but I had a big hole back here, yeah. Seven cuts in there, and 32 inches of incision, and no nerve here, bullet back here, and so I had a cast on the leg.
Like all the members of the Greatest Generation, Dad was damn near, he should have been killed at 28 years old. But he lived. And he had a son the day he came back from Europe in casts. He was so damn happy, like all those guys, to be alive. The idea of being unemployed or out of money or I don't have enough food or I don't have a good route, that didn't scare any of those guys because they'd been in combat. You know, a tough life on stateside with no bullets coming at you is easy living. He was happy to be alive, and he was going to make the best of it.
That son, who had been born just months before, was Norm Nelson, also known as Beav, whose voice you just heard. Throughout the trauma Morley experienced during the war, one thing never waned: his passion for birds of prey.
He was called the Falcon. If he would lead his troops up when they'd get up on a ridge or something in Colorado when they were training for the 10th Mountain Infantry and a falcon or something would fly by, he would point this out to his troops.
In the middle of the battles, and when we were in reserve, I was talking about saving the birds and the soils of the earth for the future. In other words, I was, at the time the war was on, thinking beyond the war, and even to the birds.
So by the time he was able to return home, Morley was anxious to start trapping and flying falcons again, and he had his eyes set on one particular canyon in southwest Idaho, the Snake River Canyon, south of Boise, which he had briefly visited before the war.
Then in 1948, when we moved here, then my sons and I, and this is an interesting thing, we found all of those falcons. I just couldn't believe that there were so damn many prey falcons in there. Quarter mile, in some places there's one on the top of the 800 foot cliff and one below, and a quarter mile over, the same thing. There'd be two of them at two levels.
They documented that there were more than 600 pairs of raptors nesting in the area, representing 15 species. More than 200 pairs of prairie falcons nesting in the area, representing 5% of the bird's world population.
Prairie falcons range all across western North America, from southern Canada into central Mexico, and from the Pacific coast to the Great Plains. But nowhere else do they nest in such high densities.
The Aeolian soils, the geology, the Cascade Range, and the other ranges to the west, so they only got from 10 to 18 inches of rain. And the fact that at the end of the Ice Age, when all this happened, the wind, it all dried up, and the wind blew this beautiful silty clay loam 4 to 5, 6 feet over all of the lava. And that's the 486,000 acres we're now trying to get Congress to set aside, because if you go south of the river, east or west or north, you lose it. Mm-hmm. You get back to gravelly soils and the Townsend ground squirrel can't make it.
Despite the fact that Morley clearly understood how unique the Snake River Canyon is, it didn't initially cross his mind to seek protection for the area. We'll explore how Morley's raptor conservation goals shifted as he continued to build new partnerships after we take a short break.
You're listening to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program bringing you local radio productions of national interest. I'm Wayne Burt of KRBX in Boise, Idaho. Together with Matt Podolsky and the Wild Lens Collective, we created a podcast series called Common Land that explores the origin stories of national parks, monuments, and conservation areas. You're listening to episode one of our inaugural season, delving into the history, science, and politics behind the creation of a truly unique national conservation area in southwestern Idaho.
He was, and he was a falconer. That's all he wanted to do was be a falconer and train birds and hunt birds. And he just wanted to experience the flight.
Welcome back to Common Land. That was Norm Nelson again, Morley's oldest son.
And then he was working on trying to keep everybody from shooting birds. That's what his main thing was. We got to stop shooting all these birds.
How did Morley go about trying to stop people from shooting birds of prey?
He was the master of show and tell, and I think in retrospect that was really one of his greatest gifts, absolutely.
By going to a meeting with an eagle on your fist or a hawk on your fist was the way you made a great success compared to going there and yapping about it. If you, especially an eagle, because it's so big it challenges everybody, they say, well, he must know what he's talking about or he wouldn't be able to handle that big bruiser.
You know, early on he was trying to get people to stop shooting eagles and hawks off the top of fence posts. That was one of his first things that he was doing in the 50s, in the 40s, in the 60s. And it's hard for people to even imagine today. But I mean, they saw him like a varmint. And sheep ranchers literally thought that golden eagles flew off with lambs. And so for him to actually take one of his trained golden eagles out on the edge of the Snake River Birds of Prey area with Marlon Perkins and Jim Fowler, and they tied the 8-pound weight to the bottom of that bird, to its talons and its legs, it couldn't fly off the ground. And that was just a classic master of show and tell moment.
He had such a convincing presence about his presentation on the value of these birds of prey in this particular habitat that you couldn't sit there and go, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about or whatever. I mean, he was just like all authority.
Despite Morley's success with this approach, he still felt there must be a way to reach larger groups of people. And then came the 1953 Walt Disney documentary, The Living Desert.
The rattlesnake is on the prowl again. So far, this killer seems to have had his own way. But there are a few creatures who dare to challenge him, and one of these is the red-tailed hawk.
When I saw what happened when the red-tail killed the rattlesnake in the Living Desert, and everybody said, you've got to quit shooting those chicken hawks because they kill rattlesnakes, and it went to 20, 37 nations, mm-hmm. I said, made a minute now.
The hawk finds an opening, seizes the rattler's head, and as suddenly as it began, the violent conflict is ended.
That was when I said, I'm getting, and I got a camera from Disney. I said, boy, and I started shooting this stuff that they couldn't shoot.
Morley started filming raptors whenever he had the chance, and he became involved in numerous other film productions. By the early 1960s, he had enough clout to pitch a documentary focused exclusively on birds of prey in the Snake River Canyon.
I took that footage down with old Walt Disney and some footage that I had that I've shot of an eagle flying right up above my house here, coming down, and they said, wait a minute, we'll do Eye to the Offbeat Eagle if you will help us write the story.
Walt Disney presents Ida, the Offbeat Eagle.
This film was released in 1965 and was introduced by Walt Disney himself.
Now, actually, there are two American eagles, the bald eagle and the golden eagle, which happens to be the subject of our story.
The story followed the relationship between a golden eagle and a hermit named Uncle Billy.
Uncle Billy soon discovered she was a wise bird for sure. No trick could keep her from the treat.
Almost the entire film was shot in the Snake River Canyon, and it brought a huge amount of attention to the region. Soon after Eye to the Offbeat Eagle aired, Morley's Golden Eagles and the Snake River Canyon were featured again in another high-profile natural history show. Wild Kingdom.
We drifted down this beautiful river to meet Morley Nelson. The young eagles are now on their own, and Morley has picked a spot not far from the cliff where we can observe their flying techniques.
While these early films were largely Morley's vision, it was his sons, Norm and Tyler, and other Falconer apprentices who allowed these complicated film shoots to be successful.
When we had seven eagles to do Ida the Offbeat Eagle, Beaver and Tyler were the reason that who can keep and fly seven eagles. That is a major, major accomplishment.
By the mid-60s, it had become well known in Hollywood that if you needed a raptor in your film, Morley was the person to call.
Once I started to work with the eagles, and we did the Day of the Eagle, we trained an eagle to catch a parachute in the air. And what they were doing was taking dope from Mexico and dropping it in parachutes before this ever really got going. They had a film about it, see? And this eagle was going to stop this. It was going to catch the parachute, and this was the story.
The famous story about Otis, he was supposed to fly and catch a parachute that had drugs in it, and they got the shot right off the bat. Then they wanted a bunch of other shots, and Otis went, I'm out of here. Because he was fat, it was hot weather. So I chased him for a week on a horse, and I only saw him one time. And he would not come back to me. And then finally I got up on this ridge and I got off the horse and I saw two eagles flying, one behind the other. And they flew right through the sun, and then one went left and the other one folded his wings up and came right at me and landed on my T-perch. And I rode back to the film crew and got a standing ovation as I rode into camp with my eagle on my horse.
I learned I could tape feathers into a hawk's wing with a black line on it and let it fly out there. And when I wanted to, grab the line that held on two fairly big feathers and jerk them out of the bird's wing, and the birds would flip upside down and absolutely act like you hit it with a shotgun, to such a point that I got letters saying, why did you let those people shoot the bird, both in the Disney film and in the Paramount film? This is in My Side of the Mountain for Paramount. Yeah.
Rightful. Killed my falcon.
Listen, kid.
Call me kid.
What's the matter with you? Are you crazy or something?
To a lot of folks, it may have looked like Morley and his sons were crazy. The obsession with raptors was all-consuming.
I was training birds to be in movies when I was a kid. When I was in high school, I was kind of an oddball because I had to go home every day and work eagles. I'm the only kid in the whole Pacific Northwest training a golden eagle.
My daughter and every one of my family, all of the three boys, I have to just smile at their intensity in the fact that they have lived with me and were a part of, and the reason that I could accomplish what I did.
It was an enormous undertaking. It took a whole family to do what one person was getting paid minimally for.
That's the voice of Morley's first wife, Betty Ann, recorded to microcassette by Steve Stubner in 1999.
I did the work that made being falconry in a neighborhood possible for Morley.
Yeah.
I'm not telling you this in a defensive way because I think he recognized that. I do.
Mm-hmm.
Falconry and raptor conservation had become a way of life for the Nelson family, and while Morley's sons, Norm and Tyler, embraced filmmaking and the artistic expression of birds of prey, Tim, like his father, was most interested in the science behind raptors and their habitats.
So my son, Tim, and I started the research with the Fish and Wildlife Service.
This was the first research project focused on birds of prey to be conducted in the state of Idaho, and it was initiated in the spring of 1966, less than a year after the release of Ida the Offbeat Eagle. Morley's son Tim was in high school at the time, and he was hired by Gary Hickman, the primary investigator for this research project, to assist with the fieldwork. When the study was published in 1968, Hickman wrote in the acknowledgments, "I express my sincere appreciation to Tim Nelson, who spent many long, strenuous days in the field assisting in data collection."
We went where the birds were, and they were always out in the desert someplace. And there we'd be.
Somewhere where the birds.
I don't know, it was kind of fun. It didn't matter.
And Tim, I have letters from him because he wanted to be a pilot.
By 1969, Tim Nelson was studying to earn an engineering degree, and he had just enrolled in an ROTC program, hoping to become a pilot in the Air Force. This was a crucial moment in Morley's efforts as an advocate for birds of prey. His films were reaching millions of people, and the first research paper on birds of prey in the Snake River Canyon had just been published the previous year.
There was a lot of big stuff happening, and in retrospect, I kind of feel like that was when Morley... He was peaking almost in terms of his own accomplishments.
But then, in the fall of 1969...
Morley's second son was killed in a car wreck up at the University of Idaho.
Tim Nelson's death was a crushing blow for Morley and the entire family, and something that perhaps caused Morley to reassess his priorities in life. It's clear that this was a sensitive subject for Morley well into his 80s.
I mean, how would you describe Tim's personality? He was scientifically oriented. Sounds like of all your kids, he was maybe more similar to you than anybody else.
You're right. He was interested in science, and they weren't. They were interested in other things.
Right.
I just found that to be amazing, you know, how he was able to sort of compartmentalize that kind of stuff and move on with his life in a way that other people, it could send them into a tailspin from which they'd never recover.
You wonder how you live through it, and then you realize a week's gone by. And you're still alive.
Yeah.
You don't know how you did that. You know. So 30 years have gone by, and I don't know how.
It's hard not to see the link between Tim's death and what happened next with Morley and the Snake River Canyon. The early research in the Snake River Canyon that Tim Nelson helped initiate along with his father was a modest beginning to a research effort that would play a crucial role in the establishment of protection for this region in the decades that followed. Sadly, Tim would never get to see this research effort blossom to become one of the most intensive raptor monitoring efforts ever conducted. While it's Morley's name that has been etched into the history of the Snake River Canyon, it's clear that for the Nelsons, raptor conservation was a family endeavor. While Tim's story ended in tragedy in 1969, the story of the creation of the Morley Nelson Snake River Birds of Prey National Conservation Area had only just begun. Common Land is a production of the Wild Lens Collective and Radio Boise, with support from the Bureau of Land Management, the Birds of Prey NCA Partnership, the Peregrine Funds, Archives of Falconry, and a grant from Patagonia. This episode was produced by Wayne Burt, Steve Alsip, and myself, your host Matt Podolsky. Production assistance provided by Jessica Evett, Leah Dunn, and Ragged Coyote. Visit our website at commonlandpodcast.com to learn more about the show and to see a full list of credits.
That's it for Sprouts. You've been listening to Episode 1 of Common Land, a production of the Wild Lens Collective and Radio Boise, here in Boise, Idaho. Music you heard included compositions by The Great Turtle, by Ragged Coyote, and The Eagle and the Hawk by John Denver, all by permission of the artist or artist's estate. The Sprouts theme music is Torpedoes on Tuesday by Poison Control Center. Sprouts is a weekly program produced in collaboration with community radio stations and independent producers across the country. The program is coordinated and distributed by Pacifica Radio. Thanks to Brian David at Satellite Operations. If you or someone at your station has a radio production that you wish to showcase nationally on Sprouts, contact our air traffic controller, Ursula Rudenberg, at ursula@pacifica.org. I'm Wayne Burt in Boise, Idaho. Thank you for listening, and see you next week on Sprouts.
VOO Portland.
It's time to rise up. It's time to reconstruct. It's time to call for a moral revival that puts an America together that works for us all. It's time. It's time to help.